Hello and welcome to the Irwin Mitchell podcast, here to keep you up to date with legal news that matters to you. My name is Carol Harang and I'll be helping navigate and facilitate the conversation today. I am a senior associate solicitor and my team practices and specialises in supporting members of the armed forces who've been injured in a variety of injuries, but we do specialise in bullying and harassment. And that's the focus of today's conversation. We have seen in recent months a number of high-profile cases of bullying and harassment in the armed forces that have been highlighted, to name but a few, that of Kerri-Anne Knight, Sophie Brooke, and more recently Gunnar Jaisley Beck, which have exposed individuals suffering whilst uncovering a culture that's allowed behaviour to go unchecked. Whilst the ramifications of bullying extend far beyond immediate distress, they do affect mental health, career progression, morale within the military. And it's something that needs to be highlighted, signposted, and demands urgent attention and systematic change. Today, I'm thrilled that we're speaking to one of my clients who experienced bullying during his service. He took the brave step of reaching out in search of justice. He's here today to share his experience and also to talk about how he's been supported to move forward in his life, as well as the support that's available. Hopefully his story may resonate with you or someone close to you. Welcome, Chris.
Hi there. Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Thanks, Chris. So we're also joined by Joe Rogers from JTR Hypnotherapy, who supported Chris throughout his journey. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, Carol. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you, Joe. And finally, I welcome Dr. Vicky Aldridge from our charity partner, Combat Stress. Welcome, Vicky.
Hi, thank you for the invite. It's great to be joining you.
Just before we kick off, this is a very sensitive subject matter. And of course, Chris will share his lived experience and the details. But I'm very keen today that we focus on the positive in terms of life after the armed forces, in terms of experiencing something like what Chris has experienced. And I also think what's important to highlight, and Chris will tell his story, is that Chris's story is very intriguing because it's unusual. And Chris, I will hand over to you to tell your story in terms of how you joined the military, your career aspirations, and what happened and where you felt it all went wrong. And then we can talk about the case that we worked on together and how we got a good result for you.
So I left school at 16, no GCSEs apart from one in technology. I worked in a shop for a year and then I decided I wanted to join the military. So I went to the careers office at 17, did the entrance exam. And they said that I did exceptionally well, got really high grades. So they sort of gave me a list of jobs I could do. It was brilliant. I had like 10 or 15 jobs that I could just pick from. It's really lucky. Aircraft engineer sounded the best. So I picked that. And then off I went to basic training at HMS Raleigh. And I did 7 years in the Navy as an aircraft engineer, did lots of training, redid my maths and English. It was a massive, massive opportunity. I did, looking back on it, I loved every minute of it. Traveled all around the Mediterranean, the Gulf, Norway and Sweden. It was great. Then I got married, had children, decided that traveling wasn't for me anymore. So I left the Navy then and went outside to work for 3 years. And then they created this service called the Military Provost Guard Service. Basically, you rejoin the military. You look after sites in the UK, so you don't go abroad, and you do like armed security at different sites. It came with a house, a married quarter, came with a pension, and I thought, oh, I could just carry on my 7 years on. Didn't know at that point I wanted to do the full career. I joined the Military Provost Guard Service, went to work at a site, thought it was a pretty good job, 4 days on, 4 days off, get a house for your family, settled, not going away, it was all good. And I pretty much had quite a good career in that. After 18 months, I got my first stripe, and then the financial markets crashed in 2008, something like that. So then there was a promotion ban for a long period of time. So I was pretty much stuck as a Lance Corporal for a while. And then all of a sudden the promotions started running again, and my reports every year were really good. you basically had to get a good report, go in amongst thousands of people in the country, and you get graded, like number one gets the first choice of promotion at a site. And I came off number three, so that was pretty good. At that point, I was running a shift of like eight people. So I took my promotion at the same site that I was at, which was really lucky. I was running a shift in a guard room with like eight soldiers, and I was the guard commander, and things were good. Things were peachy. My family were happy. I was secure. I was safe, and I was quite happy. I got to the 18-year point, and I needed to complete 20 years service to get a full pension. I got to the 18-year point, and things started happening in the workplace. I got on really well with the boss. I was pretty good at my job without sounding arrogant. And people started taking a dislike to me. Well, I don't know exactly who they were, but little things started happening. So I'd go into work and there would be like things wrote on my locker, just derogatory comments. My personal belongings would get stolen when I'd gone off shift. So I'd come back and unlock my drawers and like my glasses were missing, or it started off with really small things. And then over time, over a 12-month period, it escalated. I'd go in off shift, I'd have a sticker on my locker, I'd have something stolen out of my drawers. And it would end up being in every room in the guard room eventually. You'd walk into the crew room, you'd walk in the corridors, and there'd be stickers on the walls with my name and just derogatory comments pretty much all over the entire building. At this point, I've done 18 years in the military at this point. I'm a grown man. I don't get upset about silly little stickers on the walls. That's not something I get upset about. You're military trained. But no matter who you are, what type of human being you are, there is a limit. It does take its toll after a while. So I kind of pretty much ignored it for a 12-month period. And then it started getting more serious. But all of this time, people of senior ranks were walking around these rooms and seeing all these things. I didn't really need to report it because it was on show for everybody to see. Some people would say it's banter. But banter's only really banter if the person you're doing it to finds it acceptable. And at this point, after 12 months, I was just tired, just so tired of it. I used to go into work in the morning, driving in, I'd be shaking with anxiety, just wondering what's going to happen next. I was a range conducting officer, so I'd got fully trained in running firing ranges for like 20 or 30 blokes. It's big responsibility, lots of health and safety, lots of paperwork to fill out. So the tipping point really for me, I went to the ranges one day. I got down in the prone position, went to fire, and I cocked my rifle as you do. Round went in the chamber, pulled the trigger, and I heard a really funny noise, and my rifle failed to fire. They train you in the military when you get a stoppage in your rifle that you there's a certain sequence you follow. So I did that again, cocked it again, round went in, still failed to fire, funny noise again. So I thought, God, what's happening? It never happened to me in the whole time I've been in the military. So I thought, I'd just try one more time. So I went through the sequence again, cocked the rifle, round went in, funny noise, failed to fire. Then I had to take myself off the ranges and take all the rounds out, make it all safe. And then I had to strip it down to see what was wrong with it. And at that point, I discovered that somebody had tampered with the firing mechanism, or the firing pin had been cut. And then I can remember specifically feeling just like awful. I was in a bad place psychologically for the 12 month previous, but at that point was like the lowest ebb. I just thought, oh my God, what's going to be next? The brake pipes on my car, I'm just not safe. I just didn't feel safe. I wasn't thinking rationally at the time because of the build-up, but I actually believe they were trying to kill me. I did feel, it sounds crazy. It sounds absolutely crazy, but that's how I felt. At that point, I had to report it. I had no choice, because in my head, if you tamper with someone's live weapon on the range, that is wrong. So I reported it through the chain of command like they teach you. I told my superior, he got it investigated. It went to the service police. It went past that to service complaint. I sat down with the captain and I just wasn't getting heard. It was massively serious. I felt it. It was just so serious. In the end, I didn't really have a choice. I followed all the correct channels. I didn't get anywhere. I I couldn't work at that site anymore. And I said to my boss, I just can't work here anymore. I can't do it. And he said, we'll send you 70 miles away and you can work down there for a bit and we'll sort of sort it out later if you like. And eventually I transferred with somebody else and then moved to a site that was 100 miles away for the last 2 years of my service. And then I commuted every 4 days. So I ended up spending a year of that away from my family because I did 4 days away, 4 days at home, which wasn't ideal. I'd get up at 3 a.m. and commute. So it, and obviously the impact of that then comes with, you can't keep your house because you're not working in the area anymore. So then you have to move. You can't have your married quarter anymore. So then you've got, so basically I lost my job. I lost my home. All this time I had anxiety because I was in a bad place. It was a real, real horrific time. One thing I will say is I reached out to Joe at that period when I was still serving there, and I went to see her for hypnotherapy originally. Didn't have no idea about psychotherapy or any of that. I just said, Joe, can you help me through the next couple of weeks just to get me through it? So I went to see her at a practice and she sat me down, and I found it really, really beneficial. It just helped me just get through the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, thank you, Chris, for sharing that story. I mean, I know your story. And it was obviously a few years ago, but to hear it from your mouth again, it still doesn't cease to shock, because I know that, ironically, from your personality, you are quite a robust individual, notwithstanding what you've been through. And one of the things that would be interesting to hear, and I think I know the answer to, is obviously you approached Erwin Mitchell with a view to putting things right and pursuing a legal action, and we got that settlement for you in the end. But it wasn't really about that, was it? It was about a sense of right and wrong, as I think you've already alluded to. It'd be also interesting for Joe if you could intervene and just explain how the two of you became involved at the outset whilst you were still serving.
Yeah, so Chris came to me initially for hypnotherapy to, I suppose, it's that having something to lift and get through a short period of time. So as Chris, he sat there opposite me, and I needed Chris to see, or rather embody, what you see now, Chris as he is today. He needed to embody his true self. I could see that he was a strong, a very intelligent individual sitting opposite me. But all Chris could see was his reaction, his response to chronic stress that had been due to this trauma, the bullying and the harassment had been going on for far too long. His body was in huge dysregulation, which is understandable because of what he was going through. The problem with bullying is that the person who is being bullied will quite often berate themselves for their understandable reactions. So there's two things that were going on. There was a beration of self for understandable reactions and the reaction. So hypnotherapy, I used some internal family systems work inside of the hypnosis that I prepared for Chris, so he could actually sort of stand back from his vulnerable parts, should we say, vulnerable states of being, and begin to access the empowerment which was inherent within him and always has been. So after the hypnotherapy, Chris returned and we went through psychotherapy consistently over the next couple of years, where that chronic stress response was undone. And Chris was able to take a step back and see the coherence, the truth of what was happening to him. What happens inside of bullying is self-doubt. It's a massive part. and in seeking justice or in the first instance going to the next step, going to the boss, the captain, the supervisors, you want them to say, hey, stop this. This is wrong. But when they don't, that self-doubt continues and it can spiral. Chris mentioned earlier on these mad thoughts. It's that they're not mad thoughts. His body, his whole system instinctively knew that he was in a state of threat and he was living inside a state of threat. His body was saying, don't go, you know, don't go there. Another part of him was saying, fight it, fight them. Another part, well, you know, if I didn't have any morals and I could join them, that would also make it all go away. This is thoughts that happen to anyone that is in similar situations. It needs to stop. It didn't stop. So it took a while to undo that, the chronic stress that was happening inside of Chris.
Thank you, Jo. That's really insightful. And Chris, if you wouldn't mind, when did you start to notice a difference and how did it manifest itself in terms of the positive effects of your therapy with Jo?
Well, from the offset, after the hypnotherapy, we started the psychotherapy and coherence therapy. And then for my 2 years at that site at the end of my career, I carried on seeing Jo pretty much twice a month then. Therapy is a journey. It's not a 10-session, one-size-fits-all, which is what some people make you believe. You can spend an hour just talking about one subject and processing it and dealing with it and changing the neurological pathways in your brain. It's quite complex. Over a very, very long period of time, 2 years to the end of my career, and then I continued after that as well.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. It's interesting that you made the decision to undergo the therapy while she was still serving, and that's something you would thoroughly recommend, I gather. Vicky, it would be interesting to get your thoughts in terms of the challenges that I face from a legal point of view. I was alluding to before, is obviously there are legal time limits within which there's a limit of 3 years. So we encourage anyone who thinks that they've been affected by, you know, psychiatric illness from bullying and harassment to contact us as soon as possible. But I'm sure, Vicky, you see veterans, you know, who are no longer serving and a whole mixed bag, as it were. So it would be interesting, Vicky, for you to share your thoughts and the pointers that you would signpost for individuals and veterans, please.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks, Carol. You're absolutely right in terms of the time frames are a key point here. Obviously, we see veterans after their time in service. And so often by the time somebody is coming to our front door, actually the impact of things like bullying and harassment and trauma has been with them for a significant length of time already. The average length of time from veterans getting to our service post-discharge is 14 years. And I think, yeah, when we start to look at those figures, we start to see actually how long somebody has been suffering and struggling, perhaps before they even reach out for help. I think, Chris, it's fantastic to hear that you were able to reach out for help at the point you did, still within a system that was continuing to maintain you feeling unsafe, in all honesty. And I think that, you know, that's really key when we think about this, because there's a lot of shame and stigma around this type of trauma for veterans coming through. There's lots of misperceptions that bullying and harassment doesn't equate to mental health difficulties, and it absolutely does. We see a whole range of different mental health presentations. And for some of those veterans coming through, they have experienced bullying and harassment, and that might be the main causal factor for presentations such as PTSD, complex PTSD, and moral injury. And Jo mentioned the moral component here of kind of Chris's presentation. And so I think firstly, we need to really acknowledge that this is a real impact that that this bullying and harassment has on veterans. And the more that we can reduce the shame and stigma, for me, that means that we can get them the help that they need much sooner. And speaking to your point there, Carol, that's a key component for me, is education, reducing shame and stigma. And therefore, we can see people within the time frame that's required to also get them the justice they deserve.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Vicky. I think that's one of the things we were highlighting. And there is a lot of institutionalized bullying, and there clearly is in the armed forces, as what's been highlighted in the press recently. And as you alluded to there as well, Vicky, it's a taboo subject almost. It's becoming less of a taboo subject. But when you're in an institution such as the armed forces or the Met Police, it's very difficult because it's high performing individuals. It's very difficult to speak out. I think what will be interesting from you, Chris, as well, is if there was one key message. What I'd like to gather from you, Chris, is where are you at now, 7 years post-settlement? Where are you at now mentally as an individual? And what would be your key message to others that might be enduring bullying and harassment at a very senior level or otherwise in the forces?
Where I'm at now, I'm living my best ever life. I'm the happiest I've ever been. I went through therapy.
I'm so pleased to hear that. Yeah, it makes me really happy.
For me, the education is in place in the military. They teach you all the values and standards: courage, discipline, respect for others, integrity, loyalty, selfless commitment. It's drilled into you. The training is there. It's the management team. It's whether people choose to turn a blind eye or to follow the processes. I think that's where the education needs to come from very senior ranks, I would say. For me, I chose my private therapy route and to fix myself. I've got a very mechanical brain. I think, well, I've got a problem here. I've got anxiety. I'm not feeling good. I need to fix it. So I went and get a therapist and then I fix it. That's how my brain works. So I did see a GP in the military, and they were really nice, both of them, when I went to see them at the sick bay. I can't fault them. And then they send you to DCMH, which is like a mental health unit in the military. And then it's at that point, I just didn't want to be part of that. I just didn't feel safe around the military. So I wanted to do my own thing and see my own private therapist at that point. I felt safe doing that and like it was going to be beneficial. Obviously, once you go through all the therapy and then you do something about it and you get a solicitor and you fight your case, which takes a long time. Litigation is a stressful process in itself. I had to learn a hell of a lot. I knew nothing about the processes. And I found it quite stressful, if I'm honest. And it's quite a long process too. I would say to anybody, if you find yourself in that situation and you don't feel like you can report it to anybody, you've got to go outside of where you're working and go see someone of a superior rank, maybe at another site somewhere, or just away from there. Because I felt at where I was, there was just nobody there in my area near me that I could talk to. Obviously, friends and family you can, but I just didn't feel, I went to the head man, the man in charge of the whole site. That is, you can't really go any higher than that in the military, really. If I'm thinking about it now, would I have emailed my local MP, or I don't know, gone higher, I think. If you're in any doubt, go higher. Don't be scared. Just go higher.
Did you feel that you were initially ignored repeatedly?
Yeah, I think people did care. Some people did care, but I think they were frightened. They don't know how to deal with that. How do you deal with somebody having their rifle tampered with, live firearms on a site? I mean, bosses don't want that to get out. They don't want people to know about that. If someone's doing that in your unit, you're not running your unit very well. And it doesn't look good on you. So I think it was more about them, really, about how bad they would look. So I think they just wanted it quietened down and got rid of. That's the impression I got. It wasn't about me. It was about their reputation, I think.
Yeah. So I think your message would be to try and speak out, as hard as it may be.
It is exceptionally hard. And and at the time, you've got all kinds of conflicts going on in your head. You think, oh, am I part of the problem? There's 50 people working on this unit. So surely somebody's got to agree with me that this is wrong. And then you find that it's like when you go through litigation and you try and get witnesses, nobody will be a witness because they don't want to don't want to come outside of the chain, do they? So it is difficult. Yeah, it's very, very difficult. There is a lot of people would just let this go and never do anything about it. But for me, I needed closure. I had to get myself better through therapy, which I did. And I had to take it further, which Erwin Mitchell supported me massively. I can't thank you enough. And when I finally got the closure that I needed, that was everything to me. I dread to think what would have happened to me if we didn't win. Then I dread to think how I would have felt. But I don't know.
You raise a valid point there about corroboration, because in bullying cases, that's the huge challenge. Nobody wants to give a statement or say what happened. And just because 10 people didn't see it doesn't make it that it didn't happen. And that's the challenge, because it's corroboration, one person's word against another. But, you know, I think a lot of credit to your personality that, you know, played a huge part to get the result that we did. And it was very much a team effort, not only with my team, but with your cooperation as well. And I'm so thrilled to hear that you've come out the other side and, you know, and that there is a positive message at the end of the day. So, yeah, that makes me really happy. And Joe, obviously, you see a lot of people like Chris. What would be your, overriding message to individuals that are facing the same threats that Chris did?
Okay, so the first thing is to note that the stress response is an injury. Someone has done injury to their person. So if someone just came up to you and punched you in the face as you walk down the street, you would know straight away that they were in the wrong and you were in the right. With continued bullying, there's that niggle of a doubt, like Chris is mentioning, a sense of what's wrong with me, how come there's all these other people here and this is what's happening to me and nobody else, and everyone can see. But going back to the being hit in the face in the street, anyone witnessing that, and they'd be like, yeah, that person did it, and they would be dealt with, and the injury that the person would have suffered will be sorted out and dealt with. If people, when I say that, like, that's the first thing, is to feel that coherent truth of what's actually been going on. You're the one that has the injury, and these are the people that are disordered in some way that need to be accountable. If these bullies were made to stand up in front of everyone and the story told, this is what this person's done, that person's done, this is what this one's done, people would be horrified by their actions, and they would be seen, that the whole thing would be reversed, that it would be a psychological reversal. The shame lies with those people. They need to, as Chris says, go higher up and higher up. It shouldn't come to drastic measures, which has happened in the, you know, with people in the media, suicide. This shouldn't happen before something's done about it. So it just goes to show that something can be done about it. It's just not done in the right time. Chris mentioned he had to move 100 miles away. It's always the, I don't like to use the word victim, it makes someone sound really vulnerable and hopeless. It's the opposite of what Chris actually is. He had to move 100 miles away. And he was he was happy in that environment. It was a good environment. He could be himself. One of the things he said, the reason for that is that those sort of people, they're not there. Those sort of people. So if it's those sorts of people, there's only, you know, handful out of, you know, goodness knows how many hundreds is it there. And I'd say just get rid of those people, make them accountable for what they've done, and everyone else can feel safe.
Thank you, Joe. It sounds like the almost instinctive reaction from individuals that you see at the outset is that they become really introspective and think it's their fault and this is all their problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is, which is why people like you, Carol, who fight for justice and take someone through are so important, because it's also giving these people the knowing that it's not them, that they've sustained an injury as a result of those people, and you're doing something about it because they were failed in the organization that they were in. I've heard some horrific tales through my practice, and the shame buries the trauma, and people are still struggling. And it comes out in physical symptoms, relationships, emotional areas. The trauma stays inside and has an impact because it's not been dealt with inside of the organization in which it stems from. So yeah, people like you, very, very important.
Thank you, Jo. And it sounds like your work as well shows that there is light at the end of the tunnel, and you know, you can come through this. And Vicky, because you see a whole range of individuals in you know, the armed forces, what would be your overriding message or theme that you would want to put out there in terms of life after bullying and harassment?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of what Jo said there. I think ultimately my overarching message is that support is available for veterans, and really these things are valid and their experiences are valid. And whilst bullying and harassment might occur within the military, we know that the impact can last much, much longer and for many, many years later. And that length of time doesn't make much difference. It's still a valid distress. And we know that the majority do very well through therapy and can reclaim life. Therapies such as what Jo's mentioned, but also cognitive therapies and other models such as EMDR. They really have exceptional outcomes. I think for me, though, the message isn't just for the veterans experiencing this and those that have been through it. It's actually for all of us, because bullying doesn't, and harassment, it's not just in the military, it's in society as a whole. And I think therefore my message is that we can all play a part in reducing the impact of that by it focusing on prevention. It comes before this has happened, not what we do afterwards or during the event. This is about how do we stop it from occurring in the first place. For me, that does come back to education, but it also comes back to something that Chris mentioned earlier. And this was around processes, actually, because you know, some of those media cases that we've seen, Jaisley Beck, Sophie Brooke, they've all highlighted systemic problems in terms of processes not being good enough. But Chris highlighted a really key point here. Processes are only as good as the people that are willing to implement them. And so for me, this is about the individuals, not only veterans, not only those serving, but those around veterans and military and in society, taking their own responsibility for what we do and reducing the shame and stigma around things like bullying and harassment that makes it a safer environment for people across the whole of society to reach up and put the hand up and say, do you know what, this has impacted me, I need support. But also it's all our responsibilities to reduce this happening in the first place.
Yeah, that is such a nice sentiment, Vicky, and I couldn't agree more. I think without going off on a tangent, you know, we live in a very toxic world at the moment, and the toxicity is endemic in all aspects. There are so many wars that are going on, you know, very horrible things happening. And I was remarking to a colleague only the other day, it feels that post-COVID or pre-COVID, we all stopped and reset and we became nicer people. And now post-COVID, I sometimes feel like saying to people, and perhaps, you know, I'll ask you all if you have anything further to add before we do finish, but I sometimes feel like saying to people, just be nice. Because what you said, Vicky, is right. It impacts us all as individuals, not just those that are in the armed forces or the police, or it's all of us.
I just wanted to say just then exactly what Vicky was talking about inside of society and the organization, and just to highlight talk to anybody, because when you see the reactions of others in the face of your predicament, it's not pity that you'll see, it's likely to be outrage over the way that you're being treated, and that's what you need to see for validation. So yeah, I just wanted to add that, because Vicky's words there were very succinct and completely right inside of the organizations.
And yeah, usually with bullying, people think that they're weak, and it's weak individuals that are you know, victimized or picked on, for want of a better phrase. But actually, it's those that are quite strong and robust that are a threat, that are the ones that are bullied and harassed because they're a threat to an institution or an organization. And the whole purpose of the bullying is to undermine your, you know, your strength and confidence. So yeah, that's a very key point. Thank you.
I think it is being, if you have been bullied, you should know that there's a lot about you that's causing jealousy or concern, or actually evoking a shame sort of sensation inside of the bully, because they need to feel that sense of power to eliminate their shame inside from their circumstances beforehand that's ended up with them behaving as they are in this day to somebody else. So it's not, you're not weak. It's the fact that you're strong in which has made you be targeted.
For me, I'd not experienced that level of bullying before. So to actually say to myself, I'm a middle-aged man, I'm getting bullied, was really hard for me to process myself. Yeah, it's very, very difficult. If you're not used to it and you don't, it was a shock. I think it was a lot big shock to the system. So then I was like, right, what do I do? What's happening to me? Why do I feel this way? So for me, I needed lots of answers. It wasn't something I was used to. So I guess it was brand new to me, that level, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do know what you mean, Chris. It's hard to process because you're an adult and you're thinking, how can this be? And you're a high performing individual and you're thinking, how can this be happening to me? It must be my fault. What's my issue? And especially when you're at your level that you were, Chris, you're trying to rationalize it. And unfortunately, the majority of times, the only conclusion that individuals reach is that it's their fault, and they become introspective, they become less confident, they become less robust, have less of a, you know, a fight in them. And that's exactly the desired effect, which is unfortunate. But there are people that can help you, not only family, people you work with, charities such as Combat Stress, you know, therapists, solicitors, that just speak to somebody. And there are people that can help. Don't sit in silence. Speak to people.
I think because the organisation is such a big one, like the MOD, you're taking on the establishment, and it's very frightening. And you think, oh my God, I'm just a tiny piece, you know, tiny cog in this machine. And you just, it just feels like it's unachievable, doesn't it, at the time, until you get legal representation, until you realise that there's people out there that will help you, and you realise that what's happened to you is wrong and you can do something about it. But when you're in the military for 20 years, you're kind of suppressed in that environment. So you don't really know outside of that environment that you know, that system's available. It is difficult at the time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a really key point. People do think that it's such a huge organisation that they can't fight against it. But the reality is, and I can tell you doing the day job, is there are so many flaws in the system and so many things that are overlooked by the MOD legally. That they need to be put to task on, and that's my job. And especially when individuals are losing their whole career, it needs to be stopped. And it's not just about the money, as we've said. It's about justice and a sense of right and wrong. And whilst it's difficult and challenging, people need to speak out and do something about it. Because I think you will attest to this, Chris, that it isn't just about the money. It's about the fact that you were able to, what was happening to you was acknowledged as wrong.
Definitely. When I first reported it, if they'd have got everybody outside and said, look, we found out this has happened to Chris, we're going to find out who done it and we're going to sack you. And then that, you know, I'd have been like, that's great. And I would have been so happy about that. And then if I'd have gotten, you know, got an apology or whatever, that would have been the end of it. But that's not how it worked for me. Even when I went to the service police, they just didn't take it seriously. And it just hurt. Every time you follow a process, they teach you to go to the military police, do a service complaint, and you follow those processes and you don't get the responses. Everything you've ever been taught, and you follow, you just feel heartbroken. It's heartbreaking. You just don't know where to go.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I see it every day, all too often. And I can do my bit, and I'll do all that I can to help those affected. But the first biggest step is for the individuals to speak out.
I do want to add one more thing. Sorry, Carol.
Yeah, of course.
What would I do if I was in that situation I got asked earlier, and something that's very, very important? When that was happening to me at the time, I took photographs of things that was happening to me. I saved emails that were sent to me, and I kept like a little diary of what was happening. And that was crucial when it comes to later on, if you do decide to do anything about it. So it's really important, because without that, you've got no hope.
I'm so grateful, Chris, for you sharing and spending the time with us today, and all of you, Joe, Vicky, such valid contributions. But I think the key thing for me, and what I'm really proud of you all, is that, especially you, Chris, is that there is light at the end of the tunnel, and that you can come through this. And if you are enduring a situation where you feel that you've been bullied, speak to someone, anyone, family member, someone you work with, highlight it. You know, the old adage, a problem shared, speak to someone. And if you do want to take it further, then speak to, you know, an institution like a charity like Combat Stress, or if you want to go down the private route to feel safer, as Chris has highlighted, then look at that. Or you want to take legal action, then contact Owen Mitchell. But thank you all. I'm so grateful for your contributions today. If someone you know is experiencing bullying, know that support is available. Together we can work together towards a safer and more respectful environment in our armed forces. If you'd like to find out more about how we support our clients like Chris, then please visit our website at owenmitchell.com. Thank you for listening to the Owen Mitchell podcast today. If you found it interesting, then join us for our next episode.